I'm joined right now on the phone by two just wonderful, remarkable musicians, the viola da gambist Carolyn Surik, also lutenist Ron McFarlane. Listeners will be familiar with much of their work, Caroline with the Ensemble Galilée, which she founded, as well as Ron McFarlane, a member of the Baltimore Concert, a founding member of that group, and we've played a lot of their recordings on the radio. So it is my pleasure to welcome the two of you by phone to FM 91. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Well, I should mention you're in separate places, and we're on the phone, so if we all talk on each other, that's okay. That's just the nature of the beast, as it were. But you have a new album out, which you have done together. It's the first time that the two of you have performed an album together. It's called Fermi's Paradox. That is a title track, music by Ron McFarlane, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But, you know, at a time when people are really seeking comfort and solace in many places, music certainly qualifies as one of those places. And I think that this album kind of fulfills that need. And it's an album that was born of the pandemic as well. And I wonder if you could tell the story behind the genesis of the album, how you decided to do it.
Well, we have, Ron and I have known each other for a long time, but we had both been busy touring musicians, and so there had never been an opportunity for us to play together. And Ensemble Galilée was going to do a house concert last spring. Sue Richards, our harper, couldn't do it, and I called Ron. I'm like, hey, could you sit in with us? It's like, and strangely, you know, it actually, that date fit in his schedule because he's such a busy guy. And so he and I started rehearsing, and then, of course, everything was canceled. Everything, including the house concert that we would have done together. But we were having such a really remarkable time playing together on Saturday mornings that we just sort of kept going in spite of the fact that there was no reason to. Bron, do you want to take it from there?
Sure. We just kept playing music. It was the idea originally was just to get together enough music to play a house concert, to play maybe some local concerts. And the idea came up, well, maybe we could make a recording. And I thought, okay, well, maybe we could make a recording in a couple years or something like that. And the next thing I knew, Carolyn had called our wonderful producer, and Dan Mercurio said, well, how about June? Which seemed laughably close. I had never put together an album in a couple of months. But because we weren't doing anything else, we weren't touring, we didn't have to fit it into an already busy schedule. We could just spend all of one's time putting the album together. I thought, well, maybe we could do it. So we did. We put together music from all kinds of different sources, both Renaissance music, Baroque music, traditional folk music from Sweden, from Ireland, England, Scotland, and also original music that we each wrote. And I should say it's an album that represents all the different kinds of music that I've played, because I've done albums of all Renaissance music or all Baroque music or even all Celtic or Scottish music and a couple albums of all original music. But it's the first one that really represents everything that I do. And it really represents music that we love. That's, I suppose, the through line. If it is an album that provides comfort to listeners, that's great. It's an album that certainly provided comfort for us in a pandemic time that we couldn't play music and communicate to a live audience. So it's something that never would have happened in another time, but was born in this time of the pandemic. Because what else can a musician do besides just play music?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it sounds like a huge project on the surface to look at it. You've got 15 tracks here, about an hour's worth of music. And as you mentioned, it comes from so many different times, so many different composers, including yourself, as well as music from Carolyn. Can you talk a little bit about how you came up with this program? I mean, did you pick out a few favorites? Did you say, I've got this song, you've got that song? How did you put it together?
Well, it's sort of funny because we have each recorded so many CDs collectively, we didn't want to do, I mean, when you've been performing and recording for as long as we both have, you've already done a lot of your favorite stuff. You have opportunities to go, oh gosh, I've always wanted to do that. Let's do that in 95. And so this was an additional challenge because we kind of wanted to make sure we were bringing things that we hadn't already done with other people. And for the most part, we stayed true to that. I think Ron has one piece that he recorded with others, and I have one. But it really was also sort of a project that was built around, we have the viola da gamba and the lute. And so what can we do that, like, will be sort of mind-blowingly wonderful that neither of us had done before? And I think that there was a lot of kind of, do you love this? I mean, I would bring a thing and I'd be like, hey, Ron, do you love this?
Did you ever say no, Ron?
I don't remember ever saying no to one. The things that Carolyn brought were wonderful things. Yeah. But some things we needed to work on and arrange and basically recreate for the viola da gamba and lute, mm-hmm. To make them as wonderful as their potential was. But I don't remember ever refusing to work on one. Some of them took a while.
They did. They did.
And some of them came rather quickly.
Did you have to arrange your own pieces that you had written before for this combination of instruments?
Yes. Fermi's Paradox, for instance, was a piece that I had written for a lute solo, but it was a little more music than would comfortably fit on a lute. It was awkward to play. And when I rearranged it for lute and viola da gamba, it really felt comfortable and fluid for the first time to me.
Yeah.
So I think unknowingly in 2018, I had written this piece, but didn't know the instrumentation I was writing it for.
Yeah. Well, you wrote it in 2018, and you're releasing it on this album in 2020 in this version. Let's talk about that title track, Fermi's Paradox. Not a lot of people know what that means, Fermi's Paradox, but it has a real resonance with the tone and tenor of the album.
It has. Enrico Fermi was an Italian physicist working through the middle of the 20th century, lived in Chicago, and was a remarkable physicist. His paradox was his observation that there's overwhelming probability that there is intelligent life on other planets, other solar systems, scientifically speaking, and yet there's absolutely no scientific conclusive proof that they're out there. So his question is, where is everybody? Mm. Anybody out there?
Right.
So that's the paradox. And the piece itself, while it's entirely an instrumental piece, it has moods, it has moments that really try to embrace the sky. I have certain motives in the piece that, to me, communicate the awe and wonder that a person feels looking up at the night sky, seeing the reality that's up there, seeing the amazing place in the universe where we live. And then other parts of the piece that are more reflective, that are more indoors, even kind of a hootenanny section where maybe Fermi got to kick up his heels before again going out and looking up at the night sky and seeing this awe-inspiring sight and wondering who or what might be up there.
Well, listening to it and knowing what the title is referring to, it kind of projects a sense of optimistic faith, as it were. And that sort of optimistic quality, I think, feeds into many other works and arrangements you have on here. Caroline, can you tell us a little bit about the piece that you wrote called The Last Day?
Yes, I've had the great good fortune to have wonderful, wonderful people in my life, and a number of them have passed away in the last 8 years. And I actually wrote a book last year about it called The Last Day, and when we were putting together that set of pieces, it felt to me like it really needed one more piece, and that the piece that it needed would be a piece that would sort of reflect on the wonderful gifts that we receive in friendship and in love, and the ache that's there when they're gone. Mm. I didn't want to write something that was all about the loss. I really wanted to write something that sort of tried to contain both the gratitude and the sadness for that set. And that was my motivation.
When you're writing for lute and viola da gamba, of course the lute comes in different flavors, but writing or arranging either one of you, do you think in terms of, like, you know, the solo instrument with accompaniment? I'm thinking of like something with a piano and an instrument, that sort of thing. Or are you more equal partners when you're performing this stuff?
I feel like we're equal. Oh, go ahead, Carolyn.
No, you were saying, I think you're about to say exactly what I would have said.
Let's find out.
I feel like we're more equal partners, and in fact, to a much greater extent than a piano and violin could do. The viola da gamba can accompany the lute, and the lute can accompany the viola da gamba. They each can take a solo role. They each can take an accompanimental role. And they can also weave lines through the lines of the other. So I think it's a particularly great combination because of the inherent ability of the instruments to mix and to take different musical roles with one another over the course of a single piece.
Yeah. Let's talk about your instruments. Ron, I know that you... you told me you started on the drums when you were very young, but you went to the guitar, and then you discovered the lute. Can you tell us that journey?
I did. I played electric guitar in high school, and then got interested in classical guitar. I played both classical guitar and rock guitar in college while I was a classical guitar major. And, you know, one thing that I always loved about rock music was the fact that you have this great rhythmic quality. You have a chance for on-the-spot improvisation. There's a kind of directness of expression. I've always loved that about it, and yet I've loved the fact that you have so many colors, a very, very wide and sensitive range of interpretation and expression in classical music. And in lute music, I found a combination of those qualities that I loved so much about both popular music and classical music, partly because in the Renaissance, in the 16th century, there really wasn't the dividing line between popular music, folk music, and classical music that one tends to have now. The lute played all these kinds of music, and it was a participant in folk music and very, you know, driving sorts of popular music at the time, which I connected with as a young man shortly out of rock bands, but still very much in love with classical music. So I gravitated toward the lute because it encapsulated all of my musical loves in one instrument. Mm-hmm. So I switched over to that instrument in 1978 and never looked back. I've just had a wonderful musical life with the lute.
I've heard you talk about, Ron, about the intimacy of playing the actual instrument itself, how it kind of is physically connected to you in a way that the guitar is not.
It's absolutely true. The back of the lute has it's a rounded back, and it rests against your chest, so you actually feel the vibrations of the instrument physically when you're playing it. Also, the guitarist usually plays with their fingernails, whereas a lute player ordinarily plays with the fleshy fingertips. And that, again, gives you a very close tactile connection with the instrument, both feeling it vibrate and also touching it with the flesh of your fingertips.
Let me ask you, Carolyn, a similar question. You know, I mean, most people starting out, they don't say, hey, I'm going to go play the viola da gamba. You know, what was your path to finding that instrument?
Yes, it is funny. I was in a small ensemble when I was a teenager that did a lot of Renaissance vocal music and some instrumental music, and I decided that I wanted to play the bowed stringed instrument that I could play in this group. And so when I was 16, I started looking around, and the Viola da Gamba Society of America was founded by a man who lived like 12 miles from my house.
Wow.
And so he had passed away, but his widow still lived on Fiddler's Hill Road and had in her possession 20-some violas da gamba. And so someone said, oh, give her a call. She'll loan you one. And so I drove down to her house, and she had arranged for a gentleman who was a teacher in D.C. to come and have lunch. She showed me a beautiful Eros division bass, viola da gamba, and he gave me my first lesson. And it was one of those things that I think can particularly happen to teenagers where they find their love, they find their passion. And for me, the minute I started playing the viola da gamba, that was me. That was my voice. And and I think that there are a lot of things about it that I find remarkable and beautiful. And as Ron was saying about the lute, the gamba really sort of it sort of sits right up against your body, and so it also has a set of overtones that are really quite remarkable. And so there's a lot about it that you can play in an ensemble and feel like you really have something to say and something to add, and you can sit alone in a room and create music that's really, you know, so much more than you're actually doing. And actually it's sort of funny when I run into adults and they're like, I think I want to take up the cello, and I'm like, no, take up the gamba, it's got frets. You hold the bow like you hold a chopstick, it's not hard.
Uh-huh. So you both are advocates for people who may want to pick up your instruments.
We are.
I know, Ron, you've got a lot of stuff about the history of the lute on your website. What instruments are you playing on this recording? Because you have more than one lute here, right?
I'm playing a 10-course lute that's only 4 years old, made by Travis Carey in Vancouver, British Columbia. And then a 13-course Baroque lute made by Andy Rutherford in, I believe it was 1992, then converted from 11 courses to 13 courses by David Brown of Baltimore. So it's basically the latest version of a Renaissance lute and the latest version of a Baroque lute. And they have very, not just different sonorities, but different tunings as well. So the paradigm of what a lute should sound like changed as we got from the 16th to the 17th to the 18th century. So the construction and the tuning changed to fit the evolving tastes of musicians and listeners.
Yeah. And Carolyn, you don't have that same viola da gamba that you started out on.
No, I don't. But I do play an instrument that I bought in 1995, and I love it very, very much. And I have another one, a new instrument that is going to arrive in about a week and a half, which is also very, very exciting because it's been a long time. I've played a lot. I have had, I think this is the one that I play now is my fourth instrument ever. And, you know, every instrument is different. Every bow is different. Every instrument has a bow that it would love more than any other. It's pretty funny.
That's great. You know, listening to all the music on this disc, I've mentioned how it all flows nicely, even though there's such a diverse repertoire that you bring to this album. I wonder if we can talk about a few of the other tracks. I was talking with Ron before briefly about some of the music on here, and I was really struck, Ron, by that Hans Leo Hassler piece, which I didn't know sort of the journey that it had taken. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, a very beautiful hymn written by Hassler, probably written around 1600 or so. But then it was harmonized by J.S. Bach more than 100 years later. Beautiful harmonization, and we're using that harmonization in our version. But then, much more recently, hundreds of years after that, Paul Simon took the melody and wrote his song, which he calls American Tune, to the melody. And it actually works beautifully as a Paul Simon song, as well as a hymn written at the end of the Renaissance and then harmonized in the High Baroque.
Was that one of your contributions or selections, or
that was one that Carolyn brought?
Oh, okay. Okay.
But I did a fair amount of work trying to fit J.S. Bach's harmonization on the fingerboard of a lute. It's pretty dense stuff. Beautiful as it is, he really wasn't thinking about how that might fit on the lute's fingerboard. Nor should he have been thinking that. But we got it on there.
You told me you were a fan of the Allman Brothers, and you've got a Duane Allman track on here. I assume that was your contribution, right?
It was. That was. I was in college, and in fact played Allman Brothers on my electric guitar, my Gibson Les Paul at the time, because although I was playing classical guitar through the week, my weekend job was playing electric guitar in a band, a rock band. And in fact, I did that as my summer job also. And I loved the Allman Brothers and loved the things that Duane Allman had written. But this was an acoustic guitar duet, Dickie Betts and Duane Allman. It was recorded, I think, 1971, released in 1972. And it's just the sweetest tune. And curiously, I never played it on guitar back then. But I, right around the time Carolyn and I began looking at tunes, I had wondered if that would fit on the lute because I'd always loved the tune so much. Found a way that it would fit on the lute and brought it to Carolyn, and she put a bass line along with it, and it works great.
Yeah.
So Allman Brothers on viola da gamba and lute. It's the newest thing.
It's great to hear the two of you jamming on this recording, as it were. Well, Carolyn, I imagine you brought a good deal of repertoire to the project as well, and I'm assuming that this Telemann Sonata came from you?
Yes, it did. It did. It's a sonata that it sort of hung around in my life for a while, and I am particularly fond of the movements that we recorded. I think that it's so unusual to have an aria and a recitative in a sonata, in an instrumental sonata. And it's really lovely when you feel like a composer has given you the permission to be outrageously emotional. Mm. And so I took that. I was like, Ron, here's a recit and an aria. Let's do this. And it was so much fun to put together because, of course, the harmonies support this incredible emotional conversation that's going on for the gamba. And it was just great. It was just great.
The album ends with Ave Maria, that setting of the Bach Prelude with the melody by Charles Gounod, and I can't help but think of it as sort of a final, you know, word of comfort in the face of everything that's going on globally. And I wonder if you could just talk about your choice of that to end the album.
I felt like the sequencing of Ron and I divvy up the responsibilities for stuff, and I felt like it was a good thing to do to have a prayer right at the end, to just have some quiet place that we could go to restore. And I wasn't familiar with the tune, and when Ron brought it, I was like, wow, this is so much a prayer. And what do we need more right now in the world than a quiet, prayerful place?
Yeah, exactly. Well, this entire album is qualifies, I think, as a quiet, prayerful place. Beautiful listening, beautiful music, and so beautifully played. I want to thank the both of you for joining us today. Viola da gambist Carolyn Surik, also lutenist Ron McFarlane. The new album is called Fermi's Paradox. It's from Sonoluminous Records, and we'll put a link to where to buy that on our website at WGTE.org. Carolyn and Ron, thank you so much for spending time with us today to talk about this album.
Thank you, Brad. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yes, thank you so much for having us.